As long as we're keeping score, it's 18 holes for President Obama, 4 more years, probably, for John Kasich, and 2 polling points between Scott Brown and Gene Shaheen, maybe, in New Hampshire. From WAMU 88.5 in Washington, I'm Ken Rudin, and this is, definitely, The Political Junkie.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike
for president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 40 of The Political Junkie. Or, as some might say, we may be 40, but we act like we're 12. President Obama doesn't seem to be making friends lately, not when he tries to have a golf vacation on Martha's Vineyard and the whole world falls apart. But it's more than the right of a president to be able to relax. It's about the tone he sets. We'll have a full report on how well the president has handled tough news at home and abroad. Scott Brown is out to make history in New Hampshire. But first on his agenda is the need to win his primary on September 9th. We'll talk about some good polling numbers for him for November, but also how August polls can be a bit tricky. We also focus on 2 Republican governors who are looking ahead to November and maybe to 2016. One whose path for re-election just got much easier, another in the middle of a contest that's too close to call. And we remember a bitter congressional primary from 28 years ago that pit 2 giants from the civil rights era against each other, a battle that got ugly and personal. But first, this week's trivia question. If Scott Brown wins the GOP primary in New Hampshire next month, it will be the 3rd time he's been the Republican nominee for the Senate and the 3rd time his opponent will be a woman. In 2010, he defeated Martha Coakley in Massachusetts. In 2012, he lost to Elizabeth Warren. This year, he would face New Hampshire Democratic incumbent Gene Shaheen. So, who is the most recent senator to run against female opponents 3 times? Send your answer to trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll pick a winner at random from the bunch, and the winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. Don't forget, you can get the trivia question 1 day early by simply checking out our Political Junkie page on Facebook every Wednesday. You can sign up for our Political Junkie newsletter, too. You can find all that and, sadly, much more at our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll give you the answer to last week's trivia question later in the show, so stick around. The media and his fellow Democrats haven't been especially kind to President Obama in recent weeks. It may not be his fault that racial tensions are high in Ferguson or that an American journalist, James Foley, was beheaded by Sunni extremists. We could throw in the fact that Russia is up to no good in eastern Ukraine or that Chinese fighters came very close to an American military recon plane or that ISIS has captured another town in Iraq. And we can't fault him for wanting to take a vacation. If Congress deserves to be off for 5 weeks this summer, and they sure do, then the president does too. But there's frustration with Obama among Democratic leaders and candidates that goes beyond playing golf in Martha's Vineyard during all these crises. It's the air of aloofness, the distance, the failure, as Leon Panetta once said, to get his hands dirty. Carl Hulse has been watching and writing about this from his perch as the chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. Carl, welcome back to The Political Junkie.
Thanks. Good afternoon.
Let's start with his vacation. Nobody says that the president doesn't deserve a break. But there was a tone he set, condemning Foley's murder and then heading back to the golf course. That rattled people.
Yeah, I think that was the incident that really got people. He went straight from that, you know, pretty emotional moment of talking about the beheading of the journalist and immediately onto the golf course. And people just thought, you know, they understand he's going to play golf while he's up there. But that was the one that really set people off, I think. He is entitled to play golf, but, you know, as a president, there's also this responsibility, I guess, to set a tone. And sometimes you have to do things in a different way just to show people that you are in the moment, I guess.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, you're talking about these 2 completely different moods. First, we hear this very strong statement about Foley.
And people like this ultimately fail. They fail because the future is won by those who build and not destroy. And the world is shaped by people like Jim Foley, and the overwhelming majority of humanity who are appalled by those who killed him. The United States of America will continue to do what we must do to protect our people. We will be vigilant, and we will be relentless.
And then minutes later, he's on the golf cart.
Right. It was a moment. It was just within minutes, and the pool that was covering him noticed that. And I think just built up on the attention the golf has been getting, that particular instance really troubled both Democrats and Republicans. And this was really after we had published the story talking about the Democratic sense that the president's too disengaged from them while they're in a pretty difficult spot right now with the midterms coming. Of course, some of that is Democratic nervousness about what's going to happen to them in the midterms, but the feeling is real. I saw today that Kent Conrad, one of his best friends when he was in the Senate, joined the chorus a little bit and said that he thought that the president was too disengaged and needed to be more visible himself on Capitol Hill.
Well, before we go back to Capitol Hill, and you did write about this last week, before we go back there, there's something that the Obama incident on Martha's Vineyard, it reminded me of this.
We must stop the terror. I call upon all nations to do everything they can to stop these terrorist killers.
Thank you.
Now watch this drive.
Bring back. That was the direct memory that a lot of people got from that. It reminded them of the Bush moment and did not sit very well with a lot of people.
And there was other instances as well. When the president was asked why he didn't go to the Texas-Mexican border when all those migrants from Central America were coming into the country, he said he doesn't do photo ops. Do you think a photo op or a simple gesture is what the country needs or needed at that moment?
Well, sometimes I think that you have to do what people expect. You know, presidents have been faulted in the past for not showing enough compassion during times of a natural disaster. I think that there was a sense among people that Obama, the president, needed to get down to the border. And unfortunately for him, one of the photo ops that did come out during that same time had the president in Denver at a bar shooting pool with Governor Hickenlooper. And I think that was a contrast that a lot of people also drew. I think that people are very willing to have the president go on vacation. He deserves his time. And I think people in Washington understand that the president is really never off and that the White House is connected and it doesn't really matter where he is. But there are just some times that call for symbolism, I guess, and that's what he's being faulted for.
You mentioned earlier about some complaints by some Democrats. You mentioned Kent Conrad, the former senator from North Dakota.
Right.
What about his relationship with the Democratic leaders in Congress? Nobody expected him to be a Lyndon Johnson, you know, the famous twister of arms. But how much does he get on the phone and talk to Harry Reid or Nancy Pelosi or the other leaders?
I think that he's on the phone with Senator Reid a lot. And Senator Reid, I think, has a little different relationship with the president than Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi and the president have a very close relationship, but he doesn't need Nancy Pelosi so much to be an effective operative for him. Harry Reid is his guy on the Hill because by virtue of the Democrats controlling the Senate. In our story, we talked about how Harry Reid was at a meeting in the Oval Office with the president where they were talking to actually, Nancy Pelosi was there, John Boehner, Mitch McConnell, Harry Reid, talking about Iraq foreign policy. And Harry Reid tried to set the president up and say, you know, one thing we could do here is approve some ambassadors, hoping that the president would then call on Mitch McConnell to do that.
You mean because the Republicans were stopping those nominations?
Right, lot of ambassadorships. Yeah. And that he was hoping that, you know, in the Oval Office and maybe Senator McConnell would bend. But the president said, well, you know, that's up to you and Mitch, Harry. And as we reported, that really irritated Senator Reid. I would say that Senator Reid really admires the president, likes him personally. I think he's a bit disappointed in the way the president has treated Capitol Hill and engaged with Capitol Hill. That's the way I'd put it.
It's not that the president doesn't want to appear being partisan, because he often rips apart the Republicans for blocking him every step of the way. But sometimes it feels like he's just like giving a speech is enough for Congress to come to its senses. You know, he says something and then steps back and hopes the two sides will fight it out, you know, iron it out among themselves.
Right. He was in the Senate a very brief time. I don't think really loved it, was running pretty quickly for the president. You know, there's a famous moment with the president where he's at his first meeting of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And as you know, that used to be a big vaunted committee. And Joe Biden, who is now the vice president, was chairing the committee. I think it was Condoleezza Rice's confirmation as Secretary of State. And Joe Biden's going on at the beginning of the hearing, and the future president hands a note to an aide that says, "Shoot me now." And that kind of summed up his immediate experience in the Senate. So I think that the president thinks that, but like all presidents actually come to this conclusion, that the Congress is sort of a hindrance. They're whiny. They're needy. Why do I have to spend so much time taking care of them? But unfortunately, the way the government's set up, you do need to take care of them. And I don't think that's been very high on the president's list.
Carl, you don't write those kind of notes when you're on my show, do you?
No, I, in fact, have just written a note saying, this is great.
He's such a liar. Okay, so anyway, so there are still things the president has been doing. I don't want to make the argument that he's been just sitting back
right,
and
he's
doing
been raising
nothing.
A lot of money.
Well, he's raising money, but he's also, I mean, this talk about when Congress comes back, regardless of whether Congress acts or not, this talk about some kind of executive action on immigration or climate change.
Correct.
Or what to do against ISIS. Of course, all this would come within weeks of an election, and that's risky too, isn't it?
Right. It's risky for both sides right now. You know, Congress is coming back. The House is only supposed to be in like 10 or 12 days, and the to-do list is starting to pile up. Today, there was some threats of a government shutdown if the president goes ahead and does something through executive action on immigration. Or will the Congress have to take a vote to authorize more action in Syria and Iraq? There's a lot of things coming up, but they basically have risks for both parties. A vote on Iraq, maybe that's risky with Democrats who worry that might depress their voters. But for Republicans to shut down the government a month before the election, that's going to be pretty risky, too.
Well, that leads probably to a larger question. There are less than 70 days to go before the election. Is the president helping or hurting his party? I mean, of course, he raises a lot of money, but then you see all these red state Democrats who say,
right,
well, I don't want the president to show up or, you know, please. Mark Begich in Alaska is running ads saying, I'll stand up to President Obama more than any other candidate would. So the Democrats are, many Democrats, or at least risky Democrats, endangered Democrats, are running away from him.
Right. I think that although Kay Hagan showed up at the airport in North Carolina this week when he came down there, I think that the president's popularity is a big factor in this election. It's almost less what he does now, but it's just his standing. If he's going to be, you know, down in the low 40s, even in the 30s, and got some people have talked about the 20s in some places in Arkansas, if he's going to be down in that low in popularity, he's going to hurt some of these Democratic candidates. They're going to have to survive in spite of him, I should say. He is doing a lot to raise money. I think that what frustrates the Democrats and frustrates the White House is that they think the president really doesn't get the credit he deserves for the economy, that the economy is actually getting better. People are finding jobs, but for some reason, they don't get any credit for that. And they think that that is another factor in this election that's holding down Democrats.
Carl Hulse is the chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. He can be found on Twitter at Hill Hulse. Carl, thanks a lot for being on the show.
Ken, happy to do it. Very interesting.
And you still have that piece of paper. You'll send that to me because you really did write those nice things, right?
Yeah, I did. This is great.
Okay, thanks, Carl.
See you later.
Coming up next on Ken Rudin's Political Junkie, the path seems wide open for Governor Kasich in Ohio. We'll talk about how a learner's permit and a late-night car ride may be hurting the entire Democratic ticket there. And we'll see if Scott Walker can withstand the super PAC storm that's swirling in Wisconsin. Stick around. Welcome back. I'm Ken Rudin, and you're listening to The Political Junkie. Three states held primaries on Tuesday. In Arizona, State Treasurer Doug Ducey won the Republican gubernatorial nomination and will face Democrat Fred Duval in the fall.
You have my word that as the Republican nominee, I will keep giving this race the best that is in me, and I will earn the vote by showing the best that is in the state of Arizona. Thank you, and God bless Arizona.
GOP Governor Jan Brewer is not seeking another term. In Florida, Charlie Crist, a former Republican governor, easily won the Democratic primary, defeating former state senator Nan Rich.
You know, when I was governor, serving the public was never about right versus left. It was always about right versus wrong. That's why I accepted billions of dollars in stimulus funding from a Democratic president. Even as other Republicans were turning it down, because saving 20,000 teachers' jobs was the right thing to do.
Crist now squares off against Republican incumbent Rick Scott in what will be one of the closest and most expensive races in the country. And in Vermont, Republican businessman Scott Milne faces an uphill battle against Democratic Governor Peter Shumlin. And with all the August primaries now in the books, it's time for the moment that all of America has been waiting for. The winner of the Political Junkie contest to correctly predict who came ahead in 13 primary contests for the month. And that person is Nikita Kostyuk of Sacramento, California. And he did it the hard way. He got both Hawaii results wrong, for governor and for senator, and no one accomplished that feat. But he also called it for Congressman Scott DeJulay in Tennessee's 4th District, and no one did that either. As a reward, or as I like to call it, punishment, for doing better than anyone else in the contest, we have Nikita on the line for his 15 minutes of fame. Nikita, first, congratulations on your big victory. And second, there's no way you're going to be on the show for 15 minutes.
Okay, all right. Thank you, Ken.
So who are you? Tell me about yourself and what do you do?
I'm just a college student from Sacramento, California, really interested in politics. Been actually interning for a local congressman, Congressman Tom McClintock.
Hopefully you weren't affected by last week's earthquake.
I was not. No, I slept pretty soundly, and I wasn't even awakened by it, so I'm good.
Okay, well, that's okay, because a lot of people are sleeping during this segment of the Political Junkie, so it evens out. No, I'm kidding. Have you you've been following politics in California? Any surprises in store for us?
I think this state is pretty darn blue, and I think it's going to stay that way for a while.
And the big race, of course, is Jerry Brown running for his 27th term or something like that for governor. He looks like he's a solid favorite to win, right?
Oh, definitely, yeah. Neil Kashkari went through a pretty brutal and divisive primary with Assemblyman Tim Donnelly. That really left a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths. He's having a hard time uniting the party behind him. He's going to have an even more difficult time to try to unseat a popular governor like Jerry Brown.
You mentioned something to me before we went on the air about that you've been watching some of these key Republican Senate primaries this year around the country and what it might portend for November. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'm very interested in some of these states that had really brutal primaries. I'm very interested how the Republican base will react. Will they fall behind the incumbent, or will they stay home? Or perhaps in the most extreme cases, will they vote for the Democrat? I think that will be a pretty large factor in the results come November.
Do you have a favorite for 2016, or is it too early?
Senator Rand Paul.
Nikita, congratulations again. Your fans can find you on Twitter at Nikita_Kostyuk, Kostyuk. And the Political Junkie button is headed to your door.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Ken.
Thank you. Thanks a lot for doing this.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye. There's only one more primary day left for 2014, September 9th, with contests in Delaware, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, and a governor's contest in New York. Not enough stuff going on then for a contest, but maybe you have a question that you've been dying to know the answer to. Email it to me at ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com, and you may get to hear it on the air.
Something is wrong.
Two Republican governors may have their eyes on 2016, but first they have to deal with 2014. For one of them, John Kasich of Ohio, his first task has gotten a lot easier. His Democratic opponent seems to have self-destructed. But in Wisconsin, Governor Scott Walker finds himself in a neck-and-neck contest for re-election. We have two reports, starting with Ohio. John Kasich hasn't had an easy time as governor. Early on, he went after public employee labor unions, an action which voters put on the ballot and rejected in a statewide referendum. But then the economy improved, and so did Kasich's approval numbers. And at some critical points along the election schedule, Kasich's Democratic opponent, Ed Fitzgerald, the Cuyahoga County executive, has made some major missteps. Mike Thompson is the news director for WOSU in Columbus and joins us to talk about the race. Mike, it's great to have you on The Political Junkie.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Ken.
Before we get to the Democrats' woes, assess the first term of Governor Kasich.
As you mentioned, it got off to a rough start. He barely beat Ted Strickland, the former governor, even though the state's unemployment rate was close to 10%. He narrowly beat Ted Strickland. Even before he took office, he got in trouble for some speeches he made. He called a cop an idiot at a meeting and things like that. And then he took office. The economy was still bad. And one of the first things they did, the Republicans at the State House did, was to go after the public employee unions, which you mentioned, and tried to take away their collective bargaining rights. That led to a huge backlash. It was overturned by the voters. And a year after taking office, his approval rating was down at 30%. But it's been uphill since then. The economy has steadily improved, which helped President Obama in 2012 win Ohio, and it's helping John Kasich now. He also sort of – he tacked a little bit to the center. He expanded Medicaid, so he agreed to a major component of the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, which angered the far right. He also wanted to raise taxes on oil and natural gas drillers, which angered some on the right. He cut taxes, and the economy has improved. It's gone from 8.9% unemployment when he took office to 5.7% unemployment this last survey.
He may not be the ideal candidate that some very conservative Republicans would like, but he's certainly not beloved by Democrats. And they were excited about taking him on. They nominated Ed Fitzgerald, who's from Cleveland, and he's the most powerful elected official in the county. Tell me about Ed Fitzgerald.
Well, you know, he had a clear path to the nomination and the primary win because former Governor Strickland and also Richard Cordray, who heads the Federal Consumer Finance Agency in D.C., both decided not to run. Some other high-profile Democrats like Congressman Tim Ryan decided not to run. So he really was unchallenged in the primary, and that may have hurt him in a way because he's made all his mistakes in this race for governor. The first mistake was he chose a running mate who ended up owing a lot of money, or his company owed a lot of money in back taxes. So Eric Kearney, the running mate, had to drop out. Fitzgerald has had a terrible time raising money right from the get-go. Even in Northeast Ohio, 55% of Northeast Ohio voters did not know enough to make a decision about him in the latest poll. Then comes the last month, and that's just been a disaster.
I hear bad news. I hear bad news coming.
One after the other, the bad stories came. The first was that back in 2012, he was in a car at 4:30 in the morning in a parking lot in an industrial or an office complex with a woman who was not his wife, an Irish businesswoman. They say there was nothing inappropriate going on. They got lost, and they were just trying to find their way back to her hotel room.
I believe that completely.
Yeah. Well, you know, nothing has come out to refute that. But that led to the second story was that he did not have a valid driver's license when the police officer approached that car that morning. That came out that he
You mean the morning when he was sitting in the car at 4:30 in the morning with a woman who was not his wife.
He basically had a temporary learner's permit that, you know, teenagers get for 6 months before they get their license. And he had that for 10 years. So he did not have a driver's license for 10 years. And he was driving occasionally during that time alone in the car illegally. That really sort of hurt more than the being in the parking lot at 4:30 in the morning with the Irish businesswoman.
Who was not his wife.
Yes. And then, you know, that his any hope he had of raising money sort of evaporated right there. He's only got $1.5 million on hand. And just last week, his campaign announced that they're basically – for all intents and purposes, giving up. They're going to not spend money on their own campaign, but spend whatever money he has left to build Democratic turnout for the down ticket races.
Well, I was going to say, given the 4:30 in the morning thing and the driving 10 years without a license. By the way, first of all, what was his? How did he answer? How do you not have a driver's license for 10 years and you're going around the county driving?
He said he is a terrible procrastinator. That was his answer.
Okay, so Democrats are panicking, obviously. The fear is that if Fitzgerald implodes, he'll bring down other Democrats on the ticket with him.
Yes. I think the Democrats for the down-ticket races, like for attorney general and state treasurer and secretary of state, were underdogs anyway. But they really have a tough hill to climb when the top of the ticket has basically imploded. They're trying hard, the down-ticket races, but it's not looking like a very good year for Democrats this year.
Kasich made a brief stab at running for president in 1999 when he was the House budget chairman. It didn't go anywhere, but do you think he still has White House ambitions?
Yeah, I mean, he ran when really nobody knew who he was, so I have a hard time believing he wouldn't try to run when, you know, he's going to be likely a two-term governor of a swing state. So I think he will at least seriously consider it. He downplays it. He says, I'm not interested. I'm focused on reelection, which is the pat answer. You know, Rob Portman, at least the senator here, has said that at least he's interested. He's admitted that. So, yeah, the thinking is that he'll at least take a real hard look at it.
We assume that come November 4th or maybe November 5th, there'll be more conversations about Kasich and or Portman for 2016, right?
My guess is that'll be his first question he faces, you know, when he faces reporters after Election Day is, okay, now what? Are you going to run in 2016?
Mike Thompson is the news director for WOSU in Columbus. Mike, thanks a lot for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, Ken.
And now to Wisconsin, where the re-election fortunes of another Republican governor are not as rosy. Scott Walker became a national sensation in 2012 when he beat back a recall attempt by Democrats and labor organizations. That helped turn him into a prospective presidential candidate for 2016, assuming he won re-election this year. And that's not certain. Marge Pitroff is the news director for WUWM in Milwaukee and joined us now. Marge, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much.
Scott Walker has been a national lightning rod for years now, ever since he took on the public employees in 2011, and his victory in the recall effort was widely heralded by conservatives around the country. Remind us about that battle.
It started over something that is now called Act 10, and when Governor Walker took office in early 2011, he announced suddenly and unexpectedly to most folks that he wanted to scale back on public union workers and take away almost all of their rights except a bargain for just cost of living wage increases. That didn't apply, at least at that time, to first responders, but it did to all municipal employees and teachers and the like. And they rushed to Madison to try to block this before it became law with rallies. Some state senators left the state. They didn't want to vote on it. But when all was said and done, Act 10 passed and is now the law in Wisconsin and has been since the middle of 2011. And then an effort began in earnest to try to recall the governor over Act 10 and some of the Republican lawmakers who ushered it in.
So he has, I mean, he became this national figure after the unsuccessful recall against him. He has his supporters. He has his detractors. What side seems to be winning out right now?
Boy, the latest poll was just released, and this poll by Marquette University is usually spot on. They've had Walker and his Democratic opponent, she's a former businesswoman, Mary Burke of Trek Bicycles, they've had them pretty much tied for the past few months at about 45%. Now, there's been a tiny opening during the past couple weeks, but it shoots in both directions. Walker has gained about a 3-point advantage over Burke in registered voters. She has a 2-point advantage over him in likely voters. And some people say that in these rather low turnout midterm elections, that voter turnout is huge. So I don't know if the likely voters, that seems like they'd be more important than the registered voters right now.
Tell me a little bit about Mary Burke. What are her pluses and minuses?
I think her biggest minus is the people of Wisconsin don't know her very well. The Democratic leadership has been taking her around to meet folks around the state. But until just recently, not a whole lot of people were paying attention. The people who watch politics were, of course, she was a commerce secretary, and her father started Trek Bicycle, and that has been a very successful company. She's very well educated, East Coast, a couple of different degrees, but according to this latest poll, still 35% of Wisconsin voters don't know enough about her to have an opinion of her.
Well, in addition to Mary Burke, Scott Walker also has this criminal scheme, I put that in quotes, that Walker's been linked to. What's that about?
Well, we have in Wisconsin what we call John Doe probes, and they're secret investigations that prosecutors can launch if they think there might be some wrongdoing. And a judge oversees it, but the prosecutors can compel people to testify under oath and grant them immunity, and they try to decide whether there should indeed be charges filed. Now, there was one John Doe probe that concerned Walker's office when he was county executive in Milwaukee, and six people were charged with basically campaigning on government time. Then the district attorney from Milwaukee, who, by the way, is a Democrat, Walker's a Republican, the district attorney found some information in the John Doe probe one and launched a second one, and he got about four other district attorneys in the state working with him on this. So that's John Doe 2, and we found out it was going on because the Wall Street Journal had an article about one of the targets of that John Doe investigation, which was the Wisconsin Club for Growth. It's a conservative-leaning group that advocates for legislation and does issue advocacy and things like that.
In what way or how is Walker linked to this?
What investigators, what prosecutors are trying to find out is whether Walker's recall campaign in 2012 had illegally coordinated with third-party interest groups, such as this Wisconsin Club for Growth. Under Wisconsin law, third-party groups are not supposed to work jointly with candidates' campaigns and vice versa. And what documents have leaked out about this John Doe probe are that there were conversations that the Walker campaign did encourage him to ask people to donate to third-party groups because they don't have to reveal their donors and how much they're giving, and they can spend unlimited amounts on advertising, which the campaigns can't. And what's at the heart of this investigation is, was there illegal coordination between Walker's recall campaign in 2012 and third-party interests?
Is Walker calling this a political witch hunt or a political, the prosecution being all about politics?
Yes, Walker believes that prosecutors, and they're not all Democrats, but he believes they're going after conservative groups because there has been no parallel investigation of Democrats who've run for governor.
In what way are voters paying attention to that, to this? Is it part of their calculation in voting on November 4th, you think?
You know, it's hard to tell because we watch this stuff all the time. And of course, we think it's very significant. Voters, when I'm just talking to folks, they don't get it. They always want it explained. It's very confusing. It's very murky. And even among legal experts, they don't quite know what crosses the line when it comes to collaboration between third-party groups and campaigns. And again, the prosecutors, they're worried that perhaps politicians are now finding a way to create their own nonprofit group that doesn't have to face campaign spending limits.
You mentioned that Mary Burke is not well known in the among the electorate, and yet you also mentioned that the polls show the race very, very close. So all that excitement, that victory that Scott Walker experienced in 2012, has that dissipated, or is the state just basically split down the middle for Walker or against Walker?
I believe that is the case. The state is completely polarized, and there is such a narrow slice of voters who say they're undecided or don't pay attention. And there's very little movement in these polls. And, it's hard to gauge what could be the deciding factor.
Marge Pitroff is the news director for Milwaukee Public Radio, WUWM. You're listening to The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. After the break, we talk about a mudslinging battle that pitted two civil rights giants against each other.
Bond's own wife also accused him of cocaine usage.
Stick around. All that and more coming up. It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, before Jim Jeffords' party switch in 2001, when was the last time the Senate went from having more Republicans to having more Democrats without the benefit of an election? The answer, 1953. Ohio Republican Senator Robert Taft, the Senate Majority Leader, died of cancer. The Democratic Governor, Frank Lausche, named Cleveland Mayor Thomas Burke, a fellow Democrat, to succeed Taft, thus moving the Senate from 48 Republicans, 47 Democrats, and one Independent, to 48 Democrats, 47 Republicans, and the one Independent. And the randomly selected winner this week is Ron Merlo of Glendale, California. He gets the coveted political junkie button. And then there was last week's scuttlebutt puzzle. A Frank Rizzo button from Philadelphia, a Lynn Cutler button from Iowa, a button from the Delano grape strike in California from the late 1960s, a Charlie Rose congressional button from North Carolina, and one that reads, "I visited New York's Felt Forum," which is part of Madison Square Garden. An easy-peasy button puzzle that, of course, morphed into Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And that signaled a new deal for Catherine Barker of Barboursville, Virginia. She's this week's winner. You can check out each week's trivia question and scuttlebutt puzzle at our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. It's time for This Week in Political History. As was the case with many states in the Deep South for so long, Georgia had a tortured history for African Americans. There was a long string of segregationist senators. An outspoken racist, Lester Maddox, was elected governor in 1966. But there was another revolution going on in Georgia at the same time. A year after the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, 11 African Americans were elected to the state legislature. One of them was Julian Bond, a longtime activist in the battle for desegregation. But winning election was not enough. His fellow state legislators voted overwhelmingly not to seat him because of his opposition to the war in Vietnam. It ultimately took a ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court to get him seated. The situation in Georgia made Bond a national figure. His name was actually placed in nomination at the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago, which excited the delegates.
That we wish to offer in nomination the wave of the future. It may be a symbolic nomination tonight, but it may not be symbolic 4 years hence. We offer a nomination with the greatest pleasure, the name of Julian Bond.
Bond had to step forward and say, "Thanks, but I'm only 28 years old, and thus constitutionally ineligible to be vice president." But his reputation was enhanced. Another leading figure in the civil rights movement was John Lewis. He helped organize the 1963 March on Washington, and he was badly beaten by Alabama state troopers during the famous march in Selma in 1965. Lewis moved to Atlanta and entered politics, getting elected to the city council. In 1986, when white Congressman White Fowler gave up his House seat to run for the Senate, both Bond and Lewis decided they wanted the seat, which had a black population of 65%. But the contest between these two legends quickly disintegrated into one of innuendo and mudslinging. Their runoff came 28 years ago this week, and Charles Bullock, a professor at the University of Georgia in Athens, is here to tell us about it. He's one of the leading political historians of the Peach State. Professor Bullock, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Hey, it's nice to be here. Appreciate you having me on.
Julian Bond and John Lewis, the two giants of the civil rights movement, two longtime allies. They were born a month apart. But two completely different personalities, two different styles.
Very much so, yeah. Bond was much more the polished speaker, while Lewis was more the man out in the streets. Didn't have quite the savoir faire that Bond enjoyed. And Bond also had a much longer political pedigree, as you mentioned. He first got elected to the General Assembly in 1966. Took him a few years to actually get his seat there, but he did get elected in 66. Lewis did not go on the city council until along the early 1980s.
There was also a certain, I don't know what it was, an elegance about Bond or a sophistication. He also had this sense of humor. I remember whenever he would travel nationwide, he was always interviewed on national programs. Here he is in a mock interview with Saturday Night Live's Garrett Morris, who's also African-American, in a fake debate over the intelligence of whites versus blacks.
They've been saying that whites are smarter than blacks for hundreds of years, baby, right? And we have only had these IQ tests for, what, 20, 30 years. Now, how did the IQ of white intellectual superiority originate in the first place?
Well, that's a very interesting point. My theory is that it's based on the fact that light-skinned blacks are smarter than dark-skinned blacks.
Say what?
Lewis didn't really have that kind of sense of humor, did he?
No, he certainly didn't. No, you mentioned Bond's background. He was the son of academics. John Lewis was the son of sharecroppers, so they came from very different kinds of backgrounds.
But there was also a sense, if I recall, that Bond wasn't deeply in tune with the black community in Atlanta. He was often doing some national thing, campaigning against apartheid in South Africa. But City Councilman Lewis was fighting for neighborhood preservation.
That's right, yeah. One of the things that John Lewis got involved with actually was trying to prevent the placement of what became the highway out to the Carter Center, which went through some neighborhoods. And in doing that kind of fight, got his credentials up with white neighborhood leaders. Bond never had that much kind of relationship with white leadership or white voters within Atlanta, because the districts that Bond represented, first in the State House and then more recently in the State Senate, were overwhelmingly African-American.
Lewis also had a reputation regarding, I guess, his role during the March on Washington, which he constantly reminded voters about.
We are tired. We are tired of being beaten by policemen. We are tired of seeing our people locked up in jail over and over again. And then you holler, be patient. How long can we be patient? We want our freedom, and we want it now.
He was also saying, he also said, I think, in not so many words, that while he was being beaten and bloodied on the streets of Selma, Bond had a desk job during the Civil Rights Revolution.
Well, that's right. That was a charge that he made, that Bond was more of a spokesperson, while Lewis was more of the activist out there in the streets, leading the march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, for example.
So the two of them go into this election. Bond is considered the overwhelming favorite. But he failed to put Lewis away in the initial primary, and he lost in the runoff. How come?
Well, there were five other candidates in that first round, and that's probably what set up the runoff. Bond gets 47% in the first round, and Lewis is 35, so he's got a commanding lead. Also had most of the black leadership in Atlanta was in Bond's corner. But although it was a majority black district, Lewis did a great job of mobilizing white voters and white support. So he got, Lewis probably got around 82% of the white vote, while Bond was getting about 60% of the black vote. So when John Lewis goes to Congress, he actually goes to Congress as more the candidate of white Atlanta, while Bond loses as the candidate of black Atlanta.
In an overwhelmingly African-American district, why did white liberals come out for Lewis?
I think it was because of his work there on the city council, that he had worked with white leaders, particularly white neighborhood groups. And Bond, with his overwhelmingly black legislative districts, had never needed to reach out to and try to court white voters.
There was also an event during the primary that Lewis said he had passed a drug test and challenged Bond to do the same, and his campaign passed along rumors that Bond had used cocaine in the past. That's pretty ugly.
That's right.
Stuff.
Yeah, that actually was a gauntlet thrown down by Lewis in one of the debates, so it was high profile when he did that. Bond denied that. Later on, this was well after the election, Bond's own wife, and they were becoming estranged at that point, also accused him of cocaine usage. And even at that point, Bond did not take a urine analysis.
Lewis won the runoff that year in 1986. He's served in Congress ever since.
And not too long after that campaign, Julian Bond then leaves Atlanta, moves to D.C., and spent the last couple of decades professoring in both Washington, D.C., and then down in Charlottesville.
Charles Bullock is a political science professor at the University of Georgia and has been there since, 1968, when Julia Bond's name was placed in nomination for vice president. Professor Bullock, thanks a lot for being on the show.
Hey, thanks so much for this opportunity. I appreciate it.
It was on this week in 1986 that John Lewis defeated fellow civil rights legend Julian Bond in their epic primary battle for a congressional seat in Georgia. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie. New Hampshire will be one of the key primaries to watch next month, where Scott Brown is hoping to add his name to the history books. Brown, as you may remember, won the Senate seat of the late Edward Kennedy in Massachusetts. That was back in January of 2010. He lost it nearly 3 years later to Elizabeth Warren. If Brown wins the September 9th Republican primary in New Hampshire, then goes on to defeat Democratic incumbent Jean Shaheen in November, he will be the first person to represent more than one state in the Senate since James Shields represented Illinois, Minnesota, and Missouri at various times in the 19th century. Maeve Reston has been a reporter with the Los Angeles Times since the 21st century. She's in New Hampshire right now covering the Brown campaign and other political news, and she joins us from New Hampshire. Maeve, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Lovely to be with you.
Well, tell me, I mean, how many days have you been in New Hampshire reporting about Scott Brown? How many opportunities have you gotten to see him in action?
It's actually been going on 2 weeks now, so I'm getting a good flavor for the race here, and he's been doing a lot more campaign events over the last month or so. He's started this series of town halls in part to put pressure on Jean Shaheen, trying to claim that she's not out there interacting with voters enough. So I got to see him do a foreign policy town hall with none other than John McCain, who has done hundreds of town halls in New Hampshire.
And won New Hampshire twice, right?
That's right. And so he was here to sort of lend his credibility to Scott Brown and his seal of approval. And I've also been seeing Shaheen out on the trail as well. She is doing some smaller events. She did an event on Social Security, and she's been talking about things like farm subsidies, things that she's brought back for the state. So it's been a really interesting contrast between those two over the last few weeks.
Well, before we jump ahead to the general election, there's still a September 9th primary that Scott Brown has to win. Who is he running against, and what's their argument against Brown?
Well, he's running against a series of Republican challengers, and they are interestingly using kind of the same line against him that Shaheen has been, that he's an interloper, he's not from the state, he doesn't know the state as well as he should, and they've also kind of forced him to run pretty hard to the right. He's been really stressing issues like immigration, which plays very well with Republicans here. You know, anything that he can do to bash Obama, whose popularity here has slid considerably.
Look, it's obvious that he'll be more conservative in a state like New Hampshire than he would in Massachusetts. But do you get a sense from watching Brown that he feels comfortable in his skin? I mean, he was kind of more of a moderate in Massachusetts, perhaps running as a more of a conservative in New Hampshire. Do you see any difficulty in him making that adjustment?
Well, I think, he's getting hit a lot by his opponents for a shift in position over time. But he is very comfortable as a campaigner. He's very warm and very conversational with voters in his town halls. And he obviously has had a lot of stumbles along the way this summer. You might recall there was a story that one reporter did about Brown hiding in the bathroom, not wanting to answer questions. I believe it was about Hobby Lobby. So there is a little bit of hesitation there and kind of figuring out exactly how conservative to play it because, of course, after the primary, which everyone pretty much expects to be a blowout for him, he is going to have to appeal to more moderates and the famous New Hampshire independents if he's ever going to be able to beat Shaheen.
You talk about Shaheen and his Republican rivals talking about his residency or about carpetbagging. Are voters talking about that?
They are. But most often, the voters that I've been talking to over the last 2 weeks, most often you do hear that attack from people who weren't going to vote for him anyway. I think there was a lot of skepticism about him originally, even among Republicans here, not knowing if he was conservative enough, not really being comfortable with his move across state lines, even though he points out that he was born here and has had a vacation home here for many years. But I think that Republicans at least have started to get over that, and that's why you see his numbers moving up somewhat in the polls. And you do see Republican support consolidating behind him. At the same time, it is a great line for all of the super PACs that are in play up here that are trying to boost Shaheen's fortunes and also for Shaheen she always finds a way to talk about how, you know, he's not from the states and he doesn't know the state as well. And so that could be an effective line for the many, many undecided voters that are out there.
Although charges of carpetbagging have been used in, against many candidates, Hillary Clinton in New York, for example, and that didn't seem to hurt her that
much. That's true. I would say that she is a different kind of candidate, though.
And not many people confuse Scott Brown and Hillary Clinton. You talked about polls, and the poll long showed Shaheen up by 6, 8, 10 points or so. But there was a poll out this week by WMUR and the University of New Hampshire that narrowed her lead to just 2 points. That stunned a lot of people.
It did stun a lot of people, and I think that the first thing that we have to remember, and you know this better than anyone, is that polls in August in a midterm election are notoriously unreliable. At the same time, that poll does show that there is definitely some movement going on in this race, but most of the people that I've talked to say that what that's reflecting is really the electorate starting to shake out. Democrats at this juncture are starting to be more honest when pollsters, or more realistic, I guess, when pollsters get in touch with them and say, no, I'm probably not going to turn out, you know, in November. I'm not excited about the election. So you may just kind of be seeing a reflection of the Republican excitement on one side, that solidification that we just talked about behind Brown among Republicans, and then also this sort of malaise among Democrats. Even though Shaheen has pretty strong favorability ratings here, she's definitely seeing a drag on her poll numbers because of unhappiness with President Obama. And I think that's what the poll is showing more than anything.
Well, we remember that the war in Iraq cost Republican candidates dearly in New Hampshire in both the 2006 and 2008 elections.
Right.
Do you see any evidence that it's becoming an issue in 2014?
Well, that was really fascinating because I actually was out on the campaign trail before the devastating news broke about James Foley, the U.S. photojournalist who was killed by militants. And
who's from New Hampshire?
He is from New Hampshire, Rochester, New Hampshire, which is a town over near the seacoast. Is a small, tight-knit community. And that shocked a lot of people here. And I had actually come here to write a story on what the reaction had been to Obama announcing airstrikes. And it was fascinating because during that first week when I was talking to Democrats, a lot of them had hesitation. They wanted to kind of trust what the president was doing. They believed that this was a good humanitarian cause to help the people in Iraq, but they were very wary of going too deep into another military entanglement in Iraq. And after the Foley incident, everyone just talked about it in an entirely different framework. And I started noticing, you know, just working at coffee shops around the state, just tons of people suddenly talking about the Iraq issue again. But it is also fascinating that in those last couple of election cycles and that you were talking about, 06 and even 08, it was Republicans who were in the hot seat on Iraq. And this time it's the president. You know, the questions that people are asking are, did he act early enough? Is he doing the right thing? Could he have done more to save Foley's life? And that could have some effect on Democrats. And you're certainly seeing Shaheen be cautious on the issue because of that.
When she was first elected to the Senate in 2008, she was clearly opposed to the war in Iraq, and here she is in 2014. Has she been asked if she supports the president's policies?
Yes. I did have actually several conversations with her about it over that period of time. What she has said was that she supported the president's limited airstrikes originally, and she also has said that we must do everything we can to stop the Islamic State militants. Everything short, that is, of ground troops. She's made it very clear that that is her line. She does not want to see boots on the ground in Iraq, and she knows that her constituents would not support that. And she did say that, you know, even after everything developed with James Foley.
As long as I have you, you were also in the Granite State when Texas Governor Rick Perry came up.
I was.
For campaign appearance. And this is not long after his indictment. What did prospective voters say about him, and what were your impressions?
So that was something of a surprise. I remember covering him here in New Hampshire during his last presidential run.
Which went very well.
Which did not go well. You might remember the very odd maple syrup speech that he delivered. And, you know, there were just a lot of reasons why voters had reservations about him that time. This time, he's trying to come off as a much more serious candidate. The first event that he was here, he almost, you know, kind of made this apology via reporters saying, I didn't prepare the way that I should have last time. I'm really taking this seriously as I think about running for president. And I'm going to take the time to do this courtship of voters in the early states in Iowa and New Hampshire that I did not do last time. And a lot of people had that criticism of him here last time. They said he really didn't get to know kind of the activists in the state. And that ends up being much more important than you'd think. So over these couple of days that he was here, he did kind of loosen up a little bit. I mean, he ended up at a pork roast running around meeting voters. But all of his speeches were much more serious and much less off the cuff than they were when he ran the last time. He was reading from a text, speaking very seriously about the immigration crisis and also the James Foley incident, and trying to link the two together, which was an interesting thing that he was doing here.
What were people saying about the indictment?
The indictment, oddly enough, I think we've seen this across the country, but Republicans just are rallying around him in every sense on that front. At his first event, Rick Pack, his new political action committee, was handing out these T-shirts with his mugshot on them, and people were wearing them at his events the next day. So I think that it's actually helping him among the people that really matter right now, who are those Republican primary voters. I think it's a much bigger problem with independents who were skeptical of him and his intellectual heft to begin with. So it might be kind of a short-term gain, but potentially a long-term problem.
Maeve Reston is a reporter with the Los Angeles Times. She's roaming around Twitter at Maeve Reston. Maeve Reston, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
And speaking of New Hampshire, which I was, I hope to see you when I come to an event next Wednesday, September 3rd, in Lebanon, in the Upper Valley. If you thought things in Lebanon and the Middle East were tough, wait till you come to Lebanon, New Hampshire. The two-hour event, which starts at 5:30 p.m., is sponsored by New Hampshire Public Radio. It's free and worth every penny, but you must register to attend. Go to nhpr.org for more details. That's it for this week's show. Political Junkie is made possible by the generous folks at WAMU 88.5 here in Washington and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Want to catch the podcast? You can subscribe on iTunes, add us to your Stitcher playlist, and track us down on TuneIn Radio. The Political Junkie is also on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+. To sign up for our weekly newsletter and to check out bonus junkie content, bad jokes, and scuttle button puzzles, you can visit us on the web at krpoliticaljunkie.com. And don't forget to send your comments, questions, and cash to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. And to those who have been generously donating to us, thank you from the bottom of our hearts. Our producer and editor is A.D. Quigg. Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and webmaster. Kristen Sorensen is our consultant. And Alex Drewinskis is our engineer. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. Thanks for listening. See you next week.